Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky, coming to you Thursday afternoon, one day after the Lakers lost to the Spurs. That was to be expected.
No, you know what? They gave it a good go.
They were plucky.
They played hard. They gave it a good half. Then just afterwards, the Spurs are the better team and the talent won out.
And this is either good news or bad news, depending on your perspective. They do have some winnable games coming up. Washington's played pretty well over the last couple months or so, but they're not like a titan. They're here on Thursday, they're Friday, I should say, and they got the Magic. They're terrible. And the Knicks, who are suddenly kind of good, but, you know, then they go to the Bucks. I mean, they could win some games here, Andy.
Well, hopefully they won't win.
Let's turn those frowns upside down, Lakers
fans.
That
could, by the way, be the cause to make people frown if they start winning. At this point, don't screw it up. You got a good thing going.
Lots to talk about. You know, this is our first chance really to get into the whole Phil thing on the podcast. We've done a lot on the radio, but not you and me together on the podcast. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how it impacts Kobe and Jim and Jeannie and you and me.
And a dog named Boo.
Technically, that would have been me and you.
Right.
But either way,
I had to work it in.
No. Boo appreciates that. The play does not get talked about a lot.
I think Lobo just made a little money with that.
A little bit.
He was a person, not a band.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Lobo was a person.
I did. Like Five for Fighting is a person.
Yes.
And Lynyrd Skynyrd is a band.
Right. Lobo is a person.
Lobo is a person. I did not know that. We'll talk about that. We'll get into this week's edition of Should the Lakers Keep This Guy Next Year? You ought to be able to figure out what that deals with. We'll get to ACK. Got some good ACK question involving famous people and all that. But before we do any of it, let's get to the big weeks. Let's get to the week's big headlines.
Allow myself to introduce myself.
Yeah. Let's do some headlines. Starting, Andy, in Atlanta, where Tuesday, the Hawks, not a team that is perennially noticed by anyone.
Yeah.
They got some publicity. They gave control of their official team Twitter feed to the zany folks over at Deadspin. Drew McGarry, I believe, is the editor-in-chief over there, or whatever they call their editor-in-chief, the head anarchist-in-chief. We don't believe in roles like... I don't know what they do.
Move it along.
But, yeah, they gave it to him. Just said, have fun.
And you know what?
Go with God.
He kept it within, I think, safe-for-work boundaries, as opposed to a little bit of what you might worry about with Deadspin, because they can be occasionally decidedly
saucy.
Not safe.
Yeah.
They sometimes have dick photos and things like that on their site. But you know what? It ended up a lot of fun. I think it's something teams should consider doing a little bit more, not necessarily with Deadspin, but just the idea of lighten up your Twitter feed. Right. Have some fun. You know, get into the idea of really being social with your social media.
Right. General rule, I think, for most people in most situations, take what you do seriously, approach your work professionally, take, you know, your goals seriously. Don't take yourself overly seriously. And so, you know, good for the Hawks for giving themselves a little attention, whether you like Deadspin or not.
Yeah. And speaking of attention, Brian, or in this particular case, bad attention, the Cleveland Cavaliers this season have twice seen a fan storm their court, once to get near LeBron James when the Heat were in town, and another time to convince Kyrie Irving not to leave, because it is never too early to start trying to convince a Cavs superstar.
It's a weird way to do it.
I know.
I'm going to run on the court like a maniac during the game, maybe scare you, more likely get tackled by someone before I reach you, in an effort to convince you to stay.
When you take a look at that city and that franchise's history when it comes to retaining superstars, you have to err on the side of aggressive.
Good for them, by the way, that you mentioned that there have been multiple stormings of the court this year in Cleveland. None of them apparently out of anger.
Yeah. No.
Which would be the reason you would assume.
People, one way or another, are trying to do it out of some, I guess, misplaced sense of hope. But anyway, there was an attempt at a third court storming, but it ended up thwarted because the culprit formulated a very dumb plan. A guy on Twitter, at _GodSoldier_10, Scotty, if you will.
Besmirching the other 9 God soldiers out there.
Tweeted a picture of himself inside, what is it called now?
The Quicken Loans
Quicken
Arena.
Loans
the Q,
Arena.
They call it.
The
Andy.
Q. It said, 1,000 retweets, I'll go on the court. This ended up getting a lot of retweets, and as it was getting closer to 1,000...
But because people will retweet you if they think you're going to do something stupid.
Absolutely. They want to see you do something stupid.
Let's see if we can get a guy arrested.
Right. Scotty tweeted out there, almost there, hashtag YOLO. But then as word of the retweet started getting around, it eventually got back to the Cavaliers and their security, and this guy ended up getting taken out of the building before he even attempted to storm the court.
Which, by the way... is to his benefit. He got lucky because the alternative would have been to get arrested.
People just don't understand. You cannot have a private plan set up on social media. This
well,
stuff
especially
is public.
Not when the goal is to be retweeted.
That's what I'm saying.
If you're some guy with, 63 followers who are all your buddies and you want to show them a burrito you ate yesterday, you can probably do that without too much concern that, other people are going to pick up on that. But if your goal is to see, how many burrito photos you can get retweeted before stabbing someone, people are going to notice.
Even then, though, you're right in terms of the more, sinister your plan is, or the more, fun it is for somebody else to watch your plan go up in flames, the more you need to keep it secret, and the fewer followers you have, the easier that will be. But I bet Justine Sacco thought that her tweet with her 150 followers or whatever.
Oh, was that the lady on the airplane?
Yeah, the PR person with the AIDS joke. I bet she thought it was pretty innocuous at the time because nobody thought, nobody knew who she was. Generally speaking,
I still think that is one of the most surreal things ever. Because she was on an airplane while all this happened.
I know. But either way, if you are trying to do something nefarious, don't put it on social media. Somebody will see this, and nobody seems to understand this.
Yeah, that's amazing. All right, Andy. Adam Silver, the new guy in charge of the NBA. Not necessarily everything, excuse me.
Are you drunk?
No, I had a sip of water, and it was sort of having trouble getting down.
Okay.
I have a really thin throat. True, things get stuck in my throat. Things people may not know about me. Things get stuck in my throat all the time. Noodles, chips. I'm always hacking and trying to get these stuff out of my apple skin. Like if I eat an apple,
sure.
Anything really. Anything with a jagged edge just gets hooked on there like Velcro. But anyway, that's what happened there. But Adam Silver told the IMG World Congress of Sport Wednesday. Sounds like a fun bunch. sometime over the next 5 years, some form of on-jersey marketing will be at the NBA. Quote, it creates that much more of an opportunity for our marketing partners to get that much closer to our fans and to our players. It gives us an opportunity to have deeper integration when it comes to those forms of sponsorship. We're talking about like a patch, not necessarily replacing the Galaxy of Herbalife or soccer teams have Scotiabank or something like that. Right. It'll still say Lakers, but there could be a McDonald's patch or something like that. That's what we're talking about. Bug you, not bug you, wave of the future, kickboxing, what's going on here?
Could not care less. An NBA game is all signage and advertising and logos everywhere. I mean, whether you're talking about the scores table or whatever shirts the dancers are wearing in between timeouts, or
the shoes the players wear,
or the actual arena that you're in, that now all of them are named after some type of business. It is all one big marketing scheme. So the idea of a patch being on a uniform, I'm not one of those uniform purists, so it's not going to bother me. And at the very least, I doubt this is going to end up making ticket prices or concessions going down. But if it maybe can do something to prevent them from going up, fans should appreciate it.
Yeah, I picture this as a little 15 years ago or 20 years ago, the movie going experience was very different. You go and, there maybe is a commercial or whatever and a couple trailers and then the movie starts. Now it's like a 20-minute production before the actual movie starts, and it's not cool. I mean, you just assume, this is why the Arclight exists and stuff, so you can just go and watch the movie. But you get used to it after a while. It becomes noise, and I think this is basically how that's going to play out. Let's get to the big news this week, Andy. Phil Jackson. You may have heard. has been hired as the president of basketball operations or something like that, or just president. What was the title?
President of the Knicks.
They gave him just president. They just called him president?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't know exactly what they called him.
President. He is the president of the Knicks.
Well, so everybody's got like a different title, but president is good enough. There's a lot to get into with how this impacts the Lakers and what they do going forward and how this impacts Kobe and Jeannie and Jim and this and that, whatever. But there is actually a basic question asked first, which is he going to be good at this?
You know, I don't think
what does it get in New York when they hired Phil?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, first of all, the real wild card isn't even so much Phil's, it is Jim Dolan. I mean, you're talking about
whether or not he can really stay out of
the way. I mean, he has run interference with every single president that he's ever had, GM that he's ever had, you know, agents, whatever. He has made
it. Ask Donnie Walsh how that went.
Yeah, he has made it impossible to operate the Knicks successfully underneath him. And there are a lot of people, and, you know, for the time being, I'm in I'll see it when I believe it mode, who believe that he will not be able to control himself, that he will eventually get in Phil Jackson's way, even if it is Phil Jackson, even if it's somebody that gave $60 million essentially to save himself from himself. He'll eventually get in the way. The flip side of it, though, is nobody, you and I included, ever thought Donald Sterling would ever become an owner that would cultivate a positive, winning culture for his team. And he has. You know, yeah. Donald Sterling eventually was the leopard that, I guess, if not changed his spots, controlled the spots enough that they wouldn't get in the way anymore. Maybe Jim Dolan can do that. And if that's the case, how does Phil operate as president? I mean, what do you think his lack of experience does?
I don't think that matters. I mean, the key here is, and what I find totally fascinating about the whole thing is, on the one hand, you get the Henry Abbott article on True Hoop where he's like, he's set in his ways and he's always, you know, stuck with his cronies and he's never done X, Y, Z. He doesn't like analytics and he's not a forward thinker.
You will
offend
Henry if you do not like analytics.
Jesus. I mean, Phil said something, but
you will offend him if you don't like analytics,
you know,
or if you're Kobe Bryant.
But on the same day, you got Howard Beck, at Bleacher Report, writing about how Phil has a lot of curiosity about those things. And people are concerned that he's not going to spend enough time in New York. And, you know, Phil tried to kind of downplay those fears by saying he will be there. He knows that this is something you have to jump in. I think he used the expression jumping in with 2 feet. You know, you can't be a part-timer and whatever. But I will tell you where I think certain fears are overrated, that Phil isn't going to be scouting every game and at Purdue versus Wisconsin in November or something like that, you know, up in Madison. I mean, like, he doesn't need to. He needs to hire people who are competent and good. I mean, you can watch a lot of this stuff on TV and get a feel for it. And, you know, you can go meet people.
They have packages you can buy.
I think he'll be, which he can afford.
Especially
at the very
now.
Least, if he can't expense them, he can afford them. You know, he'll be where he needs to go, I think. And he will. The key is, does he hire people who can go do good work, let them do their jobs, and can he foster the kind of culture for an organization that he was always able to do with a team? I don't think there's anybody who has no experience doing what Phil's doing who is better qualified to do it. And I think, you know, he's the kind of guy who can make CAA's imprint on the Knicks a lot less. He can make the influence of agents a lot smaller and insulate
well,
them.
Just, you cannot intimidate Phil Jackson.
No, he
it's
doesn't
impossible.
Give a shit. You know, he just doesn't care. And if the job goes poorly, people will blame James Dolan anyway. And so, you know, he's got a year before they can really do anything anyway to learn a few things, to get a staff together, to find a coach and start that process. And I think it really helps them. And they're not expected to be very good or do much next year. I would, you know, cliche as it sounds, I'm not betting against him. Nobody knows the answer to this, but I think the idea that he's too set in his ways, that he's not intellectually curious, that he's not willing to allow people to operate around him. I don't think that's true. I think he absolutely understands the job and what, even guys like Jerry Krause, who he didn't get along with, he knows why he was good at his job and the types of things that he'll have to do to create a successful environment.
The biggest concern I have for Phil beyond just, you know, the lack of experience and just, this is a big job to be on the job training for. And, you know, as much as Phil has accomplished.
Yeah, but that's where that first year, I think, really helps.
Right. As much as Phil has accomplished as a player and then especially as a coach, he hasn't done this particular job yet. And it's a very difficult job, and particularly in a very difficult setting where he's not going to have a lot of assets at his fingertips in the beginning. So it's definitely a challenge that, you know, as great as Phil has been with the NBA, I don't think you can automatically say success, no questions asked.
No question.
But the bigger concern I actually have is just the energy that he's going to have available towards this, you know, over a 5-year period at almost 70 years old, and the grind that comes with this job. Because even people who've accepted the idea, like you were saying before, Brian, that he doesn't have to be, you know, boots on the ground scouting every single game, or that he doesn't, you know, have to be in every arena, or he doesn't have to be watching tape 24/7. This is still a grind job.
It is.
I mean, this is a job that, you know, you talk to Mitch Kupchak about what it's like being a GM, because I have before, and you never
have
downtime.
Riley is 24/7 and stuff and whatever.
And I do wonder if, you know, and some of this is based off watching Phil's reaction the last couple of years to coaching, which, you know, required more travel, more, you know, more of a physical
uncomfortable
demand. But that grind got to him. And I do wonder how he's going to feel about this maybe a year, 2 years into it, you know, once sort of that champagne blast is over and he's really in the thick of what this job requires.
Yeah.
I do wonder sometimes if he's going to have the energy for it or really want to put forth that type of commitment. You know,
there are people who wonder that. I think, you know.
I mean, that's really the concern I have, because ultimately this is a job that requires really, truly, I mean, you know, blood, sweat, and tears. But if he's into that, there is no reason to assume that he won't do a good job.
But it's just, I mean,
his presence will mean a lot.
Right. The idea, though, that he has to, you know, I think it's important to understand. He doesn't have, like, some of that grind is stuff that he can get other people to do. But like, I think if he's got the intellectual curiosity to spark that part of him, he'll be fine.
And in the meantime, his presence alone could be enough to bring in
transformative
free agents, A-listers. And that's half of his job anyway, is just to bring in
the appearance of stability.
Right.
Which is really, but that gets to everything the Lakers fans, it's a lot of what the Lakers fans want for the Lakers is a person who projects stability.
Yeah. And ultimately, though, I don't think it would be that way with Phil in there, just because I think
the
Lakers. That's
wouldn't
what I'm
work.
Saying. I mean, as
not
much
without
as,
Jim kicking himself out of the equation.
And even then, too, I think Jim would still have to work with Phil and work very closely with him, and there would still be that dynamic between him and Phil and Jeannie and whatever. That I don't think it would create the type of environment that Laker fans would hope for in terms of the stability that they think Phil would bring to the Lakers. I think there's too many bells that need to be unrung between those three people.
But that all just gets back to whether or not Jim Buss would have been willing to do it, which obviously, you know, part
he wasn't,
of it wasn't.
And,
but
you know, we've been told
what
by people.
They do?
Jim,
right.
By the way, Jim Buss was not the only Buss.
That's what people are saying.
That did not want Phil there.
I mean, the most obvious Buss who didn't want Phil back was Dr. Buss.
Yes.
So you know, and that obviously matters. You know, so the question is the fallout, does it bring them together? Does it rip them apart? Joe and I were ripped apart.
How did you and Diane Gordon? Whoa.
How did that
happen?
You know, and we've talked a little bit. I know it's been a big thing that you've talked about is that, you know, at the very least everybody gets to move on.
And
that's important, but what do they do? I mean, like, so the shadow of Phil is, I mean, to some degree gone, at least the option of the Phil parachute is gone. And so my concern, and it's always been, it's a double thing for Jim. We all, both of us agree, it's his role of player personnel / owner is a bad idea.
Yes.
It would be better for everybody if he had somebody else who did his job and he could do what Dr. Buss used to do. That's not going to happen in the near future, it seems. So you have two things. Is he a competent basketball executive? Jury, I think, is still somewhat out on that. And is he a competent enough guy to be able to rewrite the narrative on him? Because if you can't do the latter, it's hard to do the former. Because part of his thing is be able to get people here, project confidence, to let Kevin Durant know that if he wants to sign here, it's not going to be a shit show.
I mean,
I have a lot of doubts about the latter.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will help Jim if he takes this opportunity to start, you know, and we've talked about this before, aggressively writing his own narrative. I think he needs to do more of what Jeannie has been doing lately. Yeah, he needs to be, you know, on radio, on Time Warner.
Jeannie was on Time Warner
right.
this week. She was on ESPN LA this week.
He needs to be projecting, you know, a plan and a vision and do it confidently. And he's not going to win over people right away, but he at least won't look like he is scared to tell people what he's thinking and scared to present himself in front of Laker fans. You know, truth be told, some of the moves that he was looking to make, they were good moves. I mean, and, you know, Chris Paul was a good idea.
Right.
Dwight Howard was a good idea.
Right. Well, look what that means. The Bynum thing illustrates they didn't give up much of anything to get Howard. You'd make that trade a thousand, you know, what was it? Josh McRoberts, Christian Ayanga, Andrew Bynum's,
and
like,
low draft pick.
And a bad draft pick,
right,
which didn't turn out to be so bad. But
no,
you didn't know that at the time.
Right. You didn't know that.
You do that a million times in a million.
Exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, by all accounts, he was involved with what went on in 2009 and 2010 when they won titles. I mean, you can't say that he is responsible for every bad decision, but had no part in every good one while he's been around. You know, I think the jury is out for him, but that also means that he hasn't necessarily proven himself as a bad exec either.
The problem is you don't know what, you don't know what exactly he's done, but look, the bad choices, the things that haven't worked out, have worked out not worked out so spectacularly, and, you know, and really involve coaching hires that you could look at and say, really, is this a good idea? I mean, even the D'Antoni thing, which, you know, you could say, you know, the questions I know you had about Phil, there are reasons that you would think that the D'Antoni thing wasn't a good idea, or at the very least, that they don't shoot him in the foot before he starts by making everybody think Phil's coming back.
I mean, if they had known Steve Nash was going to be as injured as he was, they might not have hired Mike D'Antoni in the first place.
But I'm sure they wouldn't have.
But they hired D'Antoni with the idea that Steve Nash was going to be back relatively quickly.
Right, and Dwight Howard is the best role.
Exactly.
Right.
They didn't count on Dwight Howard deciding that he didn't want to be do what he's good at,
right,
you know, which is rolling to the basket.
Dwight told them that he wanted to play for Phil.
I get that, but, you know,
right, those are, I mean, I'm not, my point isn't to, I mean, they made the things that haven't worked out that are, you know, should be pinned on the front office of which he is in charge, not necessarily to him overruling other people, whatever. He's in charge of that side of it. They haven't,
I mean,
worked
I think
out.
Ultimately the answer to your question is if they win, they just need to win, and they need to start showing evidence of a plan that, you know, A, makes sense, B, starts bearing tangible fruit, and then eventually I think a lot of this stuff goes away. I mean, ultimately, he's never going to satisfy people until the Lakers win a championship, and even then, he may not satisfy some people. Mitch will get the credit if they do it, I guess, in the next 2 years. Kobe will get credit. You know, the star that they bring in will get credit.
It'll certainly change.
Right. But I think Phil being gone, bringing it back to your original question, I think the benefit of Phil being gone is, at least in theory, that wedge has been removed. You know, that specific wedge between Genie and Phil, Genie and Jim Buss and Kobe.
Right.
You know, other entities. And assuming everybody wants to do the professional thing, they have no choice but to move forward together, especially now when people are going to be looking for them to fall apart. There is an onus and an urgency right now on all these principals to really get on the same page, because from appearances' sake, they have no other choice. I mean, you know, the shadow of Phil hanging over them, I think, was a paralyzing thing. But it also did provide some fans with some sense of hope that eventually
this is going to happen. As long as he's still an option, you feel like he could be something that comes and saves the day.
You know, I mean, Genie has to get past this and not hold it against Jim and really put the franchise first. Kobe has to be professional over these next 2 years and not hold it against the Bus fan, you know, against Jim.
And I wonder just what those next two years are going to look like from him, like his public statements.
I mean,
it's just, it's funny. I don't expect them, and they shouldn't tailor everything they do to try to, you know, get Kobe out as a winner. They can't. They have nothing really to mortgage anyway. But they shouldn't.
No, but I mean, Kobe. And the truth is, as much as Kobe may sound off, and I know Kobe has clout within the organization, and he should. The truth is, he has no leverage in terms of really getting what he wants or trying to force the organization. What's he gonna? It's not like 2007 when he was demanding a trade and went on the radio tour as, you know, arguably the best player in the game in his prime, when all other 29 franchises would have bent over backwards to get him. At this point, Kobe is borderline untradeable, if not flat out untradeable.
Well, I mean, in some ways, he is literally untradeable right. because it's in his contract. Right. But you know,
but I mean, like, even
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, there
who's,
are few
who's begging for a 36-year-old guy coming off surgeries who makes $24 million or
right.
whatever.
Other than maybe a team who would want him purely as an attraction, and Kobe's not going to go to one of those teams. He's not going to waive his no trade clause for that. So he really doesn't have a lot of leverage. I mean, I felt like, and I was at his press conference when he said that Jim and Jeannie needed to get on the same page and that he wasn't willing to wait for a rebuild and all that. I think that was more of a message to fans to apply that pressure for him.
Right, but that matters. But that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like when Kobe does those things, that makes reinforces the narrative that Jim is incompetent. It makes it harder for Jim to do what he's supposed to do. And whether he's capable of it or not is a separate question. But it just makes it that much
it
harder.
It makes it harder.
And Kobe knows that. He's way too smart right. not to understand that.
It makes it harder, but I do think, I'm not going to say it doesn't matter because obviously all this matters, but in some ways what I think makes it difficult to prove in terms of damage that specifically comes from that from Kobe is, to be totally honest, Kobe is a deterrent for a lot of these free agents anyway. So even if Kobe was saying all the right things about the front office, I'm not sure his presence wouldn't deter people anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
so in a lot of ways,
it would help though with the fan base.
It might help with the fan base, but again, a lot of them aren't going to be won over until they win a title. And in terms of the true rebuilding, a lot of this isn't going to start happening until Kobe leaves anyway.
Yeah,
so
the
noise that he makes, you know, it may look preventative and it may look damaging, but it may have been exactly the same results even if he was saying all the right things.
Yeah,
the other
aspect of this that they, you know, the Phil to some degree is both a look toward the future, but he's also an example of Laker fans grasping onto something that they're comfortable with. You know, a very talented thing that they're comfortable with, and I totally get it. But, you know, Vincent Bonsignor, who writes for the Daily News, great guy, great writer, had a column this week where he talks about, you know, let's try to bring back Jerry West, let's being the Lakers. And
not to the Daily News.
No. I don't even know if he ever worked there. But there's that. And people, you hear all the time, like, go out and hire Byron Scott. You know, he's a real Laker. He's available. He's on Time Warner. He's sitting right there. You can go get him. And he's a Laker. And he gets it. And, you know, bring him back and get the band back together before the start of the season. And, you know, all these other things. And there, you have to honor your past. You have to be able to learn from it. You have to be able to use the institutional knowledge that develops around a team like the Lakers, although they let a lot of that go during the lockout, which is a sort of an underrated thing that happened. But there's also a paralysis that comes with it. And, you know, what the Lakers really need to be doing is innovating. They need to go find the next Jerry West, go find the next Pat Riley, find the next Phil, and develop those guys like they kind of used to do. Make those bold moves like they used to do back in the, you know, in the 80s and earlier and later. I am afraid. I don't think they're going to do that. I don't think they'll go find the next coaching hire. They're going to go find. They're going to limit themselves to a
George Karl, right. Lionel Hollins,
good candidates.
Sure.
It's not my point, but you're limiting yourself. If they bring in somebody else in the front office, it's going to be somebody people have heard of. You know,
as opposed to the next Neil Olshey,
right.
find Neil Olshey,
Ryan McDonough,
Rich
Cho, or Sam Presti. You know, goddammit, hire the next guy who's available in the San Antonio Spurs front office.
No, but I mean,
I don't care who it is.
But find the
hire
next
a secretary.
Find
over there.
The next great basketball mind before that guy becomes established. Cultivate it, as opposed to always going back to the tried and true. And bring this full circle.
Right.
If you want a tangible example of why going back to the well doesn't always work, take Phil Jackson's final year coaching the Lakers after the 2010 title. He talked about strongly leaning towards retirement. And there were a lot of people who thought that was just a leverage ploy on his part for his next contract because he didn't want to take a pay cut. But I know that you felt the same way. Watching him in that press conference, he looked very sincere about it.
He was tired.
He looked like a guy who felt like he had nothing more to accomplish. He could go out on a high note, you know, and at his age and with his health, it didn't feel worth it to keep going through all this. And then people,
and in that situation, it would have been there was no way they wouldn't have been able to hire anybody but Brian Shaw.
Right. And then people like Kobe, Derek Fisher, I would assume Jeannie, you know, maybe even Mitch, Jim, whoever, talked Phil into coming back one more year. And, you know, there was a lot of hysteria about it. And I was among them saying, like, it looks perfectly set up for a three-peat. They're basically retaining the same team, except, you know, new additions like Steve Blake and Matt Barnes could even be better. Everything is in place. It felt like kismet. Everything was just perfectly in place, and we all ignored the idea of you were bringing back somebody who had to be cajoled to return. And as that season went on, it felt to me more and more like Phil was a guy who realized he had made a mistake, and he talked openly about not relating to NBA players as well as he used to, and he didn't seem to have the energy for it. I know there were health things and stuff like that going on, but sometimes you just have to realize that, you know, going back to the well one too many times, you get greedy and you get burnt, and in the meantime, you miss the ability to move forward, to adapt.
You have to understand the context. The context that made Byron Scott great in the 80s, or, you know, or that made Magic great, or all these other things, or Jerry West function, or Dr. Buss function, it's all different. It's very different now, and you can't, because you have the same person, if you put that same person in a different context, and to expect the same kind of result, you know, the inherent Lakerness of any of these guys is the worst reason to hire them of all. It's a terrible reason to go out and hire someone. It was a bad idea, you know, when people were talking about replacing Lane Kiffin at USC, whatever. Go get good people. It's great if they have a connection to you, but if that's what you're hinging it on, you're asking for trouble. And I hope the Lakers don't get into that. So that's the big news for the Lakers. The other piece of news, Andy, Jordan Farmar, who's the point guard, one of two, I believe, he is hurt. He has a groin injury.
I mean, in the short term, who cares?
His groin is injured, and he's not going to play anytime soon. He may miss the rest of the season.
And short term, short picture, who cares?
Right. It doesn't matter.
It really, in some ways,
I care because I have Kendall Marshall on my fantasy team.
It can only help the Lakers.
Right. Other than that, it doesn't matter. It does, though, give us an opportunity for our next segment, our next edition of Should the Lakers Bring This Guy Back Next Year? Let's talk about Jordan Farmar and whether or not the Lakers should bring him back next year. He's in the news. He's timely. He's trenchant. Andy, should they bring him back next season?
I'm kind of on the fence about this one, Brian. Honestly, I can see positives and negatives to bringing back Jordan. I mean, he's athletic. I think he fits into the new NBA that's, you know, really predicated on speed and quickness and athleticism. You know, he's got a confidence, you know, some would say maybe a little too much, but
cocky,
cock of the walk.
He thinks he's cock of the walk,
but
cock of everything.
But you know what? He's a guy that has never been afraid to take big shots. He, you know, he can create his own big shot. You know, he loves, I think, being a Laker, you know, but at the same time, he remains an awful defender. I mean, just a
He's really bad.
You know, Kendall Marshall, you know, the other point guard on this roster that I think will definitely be back next year.
It's so cheap. You got to have somebody on your team.
He's a bad defender, but A, he has no athleticism, and B, he's inexperienced. Jordan has been at this a long enough time, and it's pretty clear he is never going to be better than a minus defender. I think he's probably better qualified to be a backup than a starter.
He thinks of himself as a starter.
He's a passable starter, probably better as a backup. He also gets hurt a lot for a young guy. He gets hurt an awful lot. He's had three major injuries this year.
His last season before heading over to Europe, he was hurt a lot. He played 39 games. I think that mostly was injury.
He also had he had knee surgery, I believe, his second year with the Lakers.
His first four seasons with the Lakers, he played a lot of games. But he's
been getting dinged up a lot.
Certainly this season he's been banged up.
For a young player. I would say right now, I'd probably keep him, but it's much more of a coin flip than I thought it would be like 3 months ago, because truth be told, he has played well. He just hasn't overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, for whatever it's worth, and we've had this debate, he's one of their more productive players, and the team tends to be more productive when he's played. I mean, his plus-minus splits and all that kind of stuff. He's on the good half of the team, despite the fact that he is, as you say, really bad defensively. Mm-hmm. You know, he shot the ball well. He's shooting like 46% from three, and he's, you know, put up some big point totals when he's had a chance to play a lot, and, you know, when he's kind of been the guy back there. And I agree with you. There's like this thing, it just hasn't worked. And maybe it's the context of the season which hasn't worked. Maybe it's just because he's been in and out of the lineup so much that it hasn't worked. But something just doesn't feel like you're saying, is, oh man, we need to get that guy. Like, that guy actually could be a nice piece going forward for like a good team in the next 2 or 3 years. Whereas even somebody like Wes Johnson, who we've talked about, like if they could ever get good, he feels like somebody that might be useful. Or Xavier Henry, or some of these guys that could grow into it. I'll be a sort of a qualified no. If you're a qualified yes, I'll be kind of a qualified no. And I agree with you. I'm kind of surprised. I had a really high hopes for Jordan. All right, so that is Jordan Farmar. That is the situation in the front office. That is everything, Andy, except for ACK.
ACK!
Ask a Kamenetsky. You ask us questions on Twitter, on Facebook. At Cam Brothers is the Twitter. Kamenetsky Brothers is the Facebook. If you happen to see us, you can just shout one out.
Yeah, just ask us a question.
It would be helpful if you wrote it down, though, because we might not hear you clearly, or we might forget.
Yeah, we got a lot going on.
Right, so if you see us and want to hand deliver an ACK question, that's fine.
It'd actually be kind of flattering.
Don't look crazy-eyed when you do it.
No. Don't be like Crazy Eyes on Orange is the New Black.
No, don't do that. But you know,
because she looks crazy.
Yes. We love
her. Although we've come to learn there's a lot going on with her.
First question this week, Andy, from at Tackathrater, Tacky C. You've briefly talked about going to the same school as the Sklar brothers. For an update, Andy went to elementary school with Randy and Jason Sklar. People
known
you may
them
know.
Like my whole life.
Which pair would make the better buddy cop movie?
It's an interesting question. The Sklars, their advantages, they are much more comfortable in front of a camera. They have far more experience doing TV
yes.
and movies.
Certainly
than
more
I
comfortable
do.
Acting.
Oh yeah, there's no question. They're going to have an easier time getting this movie greenlit.
That is
in
true.
The first place. They've got more cachet in Hollywood. They also know more people in Hollywood in terms of actors, funny men, comics, things like that.
Funny men.
Funny men. So they're going to be able to get more people attached to this movie, which in turn...
That makes it help. It's an
makes
important consideration.
Makes it a lot easier to greenlit. What I think you and I have going in our favor, Brian, we are easier to tell apart than Randy and Jason.
That is weird. Mostly because they're twins.
And we're not.
And we're not. So, although, there's a nice girl who follows us on Twitter who thought we were.
Yeah, occasionally people ask if we are, just because I think we generally look about the same age
right.
or whatever. But there are some people who think we look a lot
it's
alike.
Not it, people,
some people
don't get fooled by the avatar.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
not us.
No, there are some
that people. Is some those are the Nelson twins,
right? But we are not twins.
No.
I think we have less commonalities in our personality. I think there's more differences between you and I than there are between Randy or Jason.
I gotta be honest with you. Every once in a while, I run into one of those guys on the street, and I just hate it because I don't know which one it is.
So, I mean, in that sense, because, you know, whenever a buddy cop comedy set up, a buddy cop, one of them's either the good cop or the bad cop, one of them's the straight-laced
usually
cop,
one's
the other
black.
One's right, one of them's wacky.
That's going to be a problem for both sides.
If you have not seen it, make sure to watch the episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where the gang takes it upon themselves to remake, I believe it's Lethal Weapon 6.
Good film.
Themselves. Amazing. We also have, I think, less established personalities, personas, mm-hmm. which could make it easier for one of us, or even both of us, to play against type. But in the end, in Hollywood, money talks, so it's going to be the Sklar brothers.
Yeah, but I don't know if that necessarily makes a better buddy cop movie. Here's my problem with the Sklars. First of all, very Jewy. They're very,
no,
very
I know.
Jewy.
They don't have, you know, a rugged, waspy look
right.
like you and me.
No. A little too Jewy, mm-hmm. I think you could
oh,
even
yeah.
argue.
Well,
also,
Brian, I think they were raised a little more Jewish than you and me.
Possibly. Most Catholics are raised more Jewish. Second thing, little known fact, there's only one of them. The second Sklar brother is actually CGI.
Right. He's like a hologram, like
right.
Tupac.
It's so that is a problem. Just to think about. So I think the answer is us.
Okay, well, fair enough. We're split on that like we are with Jordan Farmar. From JJ Garcia at JSO_fly, since the Earth is spherical, are we technically standing sideways?
I think the answer to that is yes. I think we are, and I don't know why everything isn't rolling off the side.
You know what? Like Occam's razor, the simplest explanation with the fewest hypotheses, that's usually the correct answer. I see flat.
I spent a year in Australia, and I'm pretty sure I was upside down for most of that time, yet it felt okay, and like things didn't fall out of my pockets. I get why, like I get it, but it still seems, I cannot be the only person who thinks of somebody, because we're fortunately, as a North American, at least part of the time, we're on top.
Right.
Because we're north. I think scientifically that is true. I cannot be the only person who visualizes people on the other side of the planet as upside down.
No, there's
stuck to the bottom of the Earth.
There is a reason people thought that it was flat. It makes sense. When you look at visual confirmation, makes sense that it's flat.
I peek out my head out my window every morning. It looks flat.
Right. People used to travel. They traveled across flat plains, and they never went upside down at any point. I get why they eventually came to, you know, they came to the eventually
wrong conclusion.
I also
get why they thought there were sea monsters and dragons at the end.
Well, that shit's real.
Because you do not want to go over the edge.
Nope.
All right, last question from @Jace_Sun, Jason Torres @CamBrothers. Which of the two of you would win in a fight? I assume they mean fist fight.
Right.
As opposed to a battle of wits.
No.
Which I would destroy you.
No. Plus, nobody cares about that. People want to see violence.
Fight.
Violence. I think it's really, Brian, a matter of how long the fight lasts. You know, I mean, most of them don't go that long.
The dirty little secret of adults fighting is they tend to be very short.
Or even because teenagers fighting,
they almost always tend to be short.
I mean, you know, there's...
Fighting is hard, and it takes a lot of
effort.
It's
hard work. You know, people, always bystanders, have the natural instinct to break them up. But I think if it's a fight on the longer side, Brian, you would end up winning because I think right now you are better conditioned than I am. You go to the gym more regularly than I do.
That is a scathing indictment of your condition.
I still look better than you, which is what's amazing about it. But I think right now you have better cardio than I do. You probably just have better endurance. So the longer the fight goes, the more that plays into your favor.
That's my strategy.
However, the shorter the fight goes, I think I'm going to end up winning. A, relatively speaking, and I don't want to oversell this because neither one of us, you know, grew up street fighting men, but I've been in more fights than you've been in.
Yeah, I was in a fight in second grade. Harun Chisti, I laid him out. I mean, right. he looked at me cross-handed, and I had one punch. Boom. Chisti. Down.
I've been in fights more recent than second grade.
Yeah.
I think I'm the more relative.
Threw a punch in a hockey game.
Right.
I've broken up fights, but I've never been in a fight.
I'm the more relatively experienced fighter than you. I also think I have a worse temper than you do.
That's true.
Which means, Brian, I'm more inclined to go dirty, I think, than you are to do something that really, like, a few hours later.
Reggie Evans.
What?
You can go Reggie Evans?
I might. Reggie Evans.
So that's like two lines you're crossing.
I might go Reggie Evans. I might go like WWF Foreign Object. I might grab, you know, piece of barbed wire, whatever. I'm going to do something that a few hours later, I'm going to really regret and apologize for. I'm going to feel terrible about it, but I'm more likely to lose my temper and really just go the dirty route. Plus two, I'm the older brother, which means A, I've got the psychological advantage of you thinking of me as the older brother, and also I ain't gonna lose to my younger brother.
Well, I would discount the first part. Like, I'm not gonna be like, I can't beat up my older brother.
It's gonna take you back to when you were five, and I seemed, you know, like a man.
Well, that was like the last time I think we did get into a fight. I was probably like five or six.
Right.
We didn't fight much going up.
No, we didn't. I'll tell you this much. It's not going to be one hell of a fight to watch.
No. I don't think it would be like super slappy. Like a total girl fight?
No, no. I think we'd really be swinging. You're not going to be impressed.
I don't want to get hit in the face. And you've got like big bear paw hands. We do have big hands.
They
can't catch anything. And they're not good at like fine motor skills and whatever. You type like a horse.
But I do have big hands.
Right, maybe it's
like
giant hooves hitting.
No, I got big, strong hands, man.
Hooves on the keyboard. It's ridiculous. But
no Steve Mason.
That gets an advantage for you.
Yeah.
Bigger hands in a fight. I think that's a big deal. Like
it
more
is.
Surface area.
Well,
it's physics.
They say you throw hands, I got bigger hands.
It's physics, like why you don't fall off the end of the earth.
Yeah, taking it all full circle.
So Andy is the early favorite in that. So we got, I think that's,
everything.
That's everything. That's Ack, that's Phil, that's Kobe, that's Jordan Farmar. It's the headlines. A lot of juicy stories this week. We may not have as many coming up, but we'll try.
We'll figure it out.
It's always entertaining one way or the other. We'll see everybody next week.